till the reappearance of the mom lasts only 15 nights.
All right, so there's just a 15 nights gap between the reappearance of Imam and the martyrdom of Nafs al-Zakiyya. Thank you so much, Dr. Alevi, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners.
Welcome.
You were listening to IRIB English Radio.
The Gaza Strip has been suffering a crisis and difficult humanitarian circumstances. Israel started two wars on Gaza that resulted in destroying the infrastructure and ruining most fields. Israel has been imposing a siege on the Strip for more than 7 years, in addition to blocking the crossings and preventing people from traveling. Palestinian women played a significant role in highlighting these issues in media.
This indicates that the Palestinian society is developed and knows the importance of media. It was introduced to it in a miserable condition, as Israel is imposing a blockade and encroaching the Palestinians. Therefore, there must be a Palestinian reaction to document this situation. So, the Palestinians' media was the first to play the role in this field by graduating a Palestinian generation that is aware of what happens.
Practically, the beginning of journalism and production companies in the Gaza Strip witnessed a difficulty in women engagement. I can say that I lived two eras. The first was at the age of 16, which was too early and media was not developed. After that, people got used to intensive presence of media, women working there, and partnership between both genders. Why did it become normal? It was because the society realized that media is the base in the life of a society like Palestinians. We are the owners of a cause. This cause is only expressed to the whole world through media.
We started with the number of 100, then 200 after a few years. The number was constant for 4 to 5 years until 3 years ago. There were 650 students. Now there are 1,100 students enrolled in the Faculty of Journalism. The female students were forming 50% of the total number in the past years. However, it became 60 to 62%. And the rest are male students.
We receive applications of joining the journalists' syndicate every day, especially of female journalism graduates. Female members of the syndicate are nearly 30% in whole Palestine and 25% in Gaza. This number is a good one for them as females.
Arab women in general suffer, in an Eastern society, from some traditions and beliefs that prevent them from working in certain careers. One of these careers is media and journalism. However, Palestinian women, in particular, were distinguished with making some breakthroughs. They achieved tangible success in careers related to radio and television in general, either as camera women, video editors, producers, directors, or anchors.
We as journalists are capable of delivering our message to the world through the culture and the mind energy we have. This happens through what happens around us and what we live. The University of Palestine has more than one major of media. There are public relations, interpretation, electronic journalism, and radio and television. This way, students have the opinion to choose one of these majors with what suits their environment and interests.
When I first studied media, I knew that I would have to go out many times, and there are some surprising things that may happen. Especially that here in the Gaza Strip, there may suddenly happen bombing or breaking into the strip or something like that. I know that my work requires that I be ready anytime.
No doubt the female journalist students in the Gaza Strip could get the respect and admiration of the society and its support in different ways. This includes families and other parts of society. For female journalists, their career is respected among society and is not similar to any other career.
This is a full-time job that requires time and effort. I use my time here to produce some dramas that embody the reality we live and some social series. These series may be comedies or patriotic.
Indicators of the situation in Gaza Strip are frightening. Unprecedented levels of poverty, unemployment, and dependence on aid have put so much pressure on Gazans.
I started my work about 8 years ago as a TV correspondent. As soon as I started, there has been a lot of difficulties, mainly the political situation. Working as a journalist in general, or a correspondent in particular, has its own difficulties. I'm a mother of four, and of course, coming to work, you always face the difficulties of coming to work, the threats everybody else here is facing, plus having to leave my children home alone. Well, it takes a lot of effort. I mean, I have to work extra hours sometimes, and my kids have to give in on a lot of things. I mean, I don't cook all the time, that's one thing, but they have gotten used to the lifestyle. Plus, our work is difficult when it's, you know, the season is hot, when there are war. Other times I have, you know, some easier times, but so it's give and take.
صعب على فتاة أن تقتحم مجال خصوصا في بلد ساخن.
It's hard for a woman to work in this field, especially in a country that lives many proceedings and a conservative society. The beginning was hard, but at the end I proved myself and succeeded. I have proven that what I'm doing is a patriotic duty. Practically, if I manage work and home together, I can be successful in both. However, managing both comes at the expense of losing my comfort and psychological relief and even sleep hours.
Photography is maybe one of the most difficult media arts. That's because a woman is carrying her camera and taking photos like what other male journalists do. She exerts efforts and tries to be the number one. Thus, the way society looks at this was harsh at the beginning. They didn't accept that. But we overcame that now, and they started facilitating the female journalist mission and providing support. Some people knew my name and missed me, especially during the clashes of East Jabalia, as I was the only female shooting there. They're contacting me on Facebook and asking me where my visit is. They also offer help in case I can't go there. At the beginning of my career, the first challenge was my father, brothers, and my husband inquiring about what I'm doing. I was able to prove myself and make them change their attitude. The pressure was big that I was a mother and studying and working at the same time. I had to manage these things without losing any of the three sides.
I was living in hard circumstances lately because I was doing my master's. That made me leave home for long hours, sometimes 12 hours. For sure, that affected me psychologically and physically. It also influenced my family, including my daughter and husband, and my social life.
Luckily enough, I haven't faced any difficulties as a woman. I mean, Palestinians are used to women being always part of the life, the struggle. They have always been there, whether as political participants or working in all different fields. So I haven't faced any difficulties. I mean, the Palestinian society accepts the woman as part of it, so they even support us.
Nowadays, there is great development of the society's attitude to a female journalist. It became the opposite, as they would help and excuse her when she's late for home. Of course, there are exceptions. However, essentially, a successful female journalist takes care of herself and takes the society's traditions into consideration. This way, she will be respected, as I experienced.
One of the tiring things is that I'm pregnant and about to deliver a baby. It's possible to have the delivery symptoms any moment, but I'm still working. Despite everything, I'm happy that I'm working in my field and serving my nation and society. It's a national duty I should do.
To be a journalist in Gaza, working under aggressions, pressure, bad situation, financial cases of a humanitarian crisis gives you courage and a big power and strong points, beliefs, methods to do and achieve more and more and more. And this is very important for my job right now, to prove that you are strong to be here in this position.
My first experience in war covering was disastrous and sad because it was hard to see casualties and martyrs of your nation. However, it was a big challenge for me that I could prove myself in the field. Other journalists were helpful as I was moving with them in their vehicles. We used to move together whenever there was bombing or shelling to the location. I challenged myself to hold back my tears in front of the martyrs' families and the fragments of children's bodies. Similar things happened during the funeral of al-Darju children. I fainted after trying to touch their dead bodies. As a mother, I was strongly affected, and then I got over it.
We experience exceptional circumstances in Gaza. Anytime Israeli forces may break into the strip or bomb it, we may have clashes with the army. So I need to be ready and present anytime, ready to leave home to work to cover the news. This requires effort and time of what I say for my family.
I have just graduated from university and I started working before that. I was working at more than one place. I was an announcer in addition to other things. Besides that, I was a student and had a life. Society is divided into categories according to people's attitude to a working woman in general, and a female journalist in particular. For example, some people are open-minded and respect female journalists because their job is tiring. They have enough of work, pressure, are in front of the camera and under different kinds of pressure. Some other people have another viewpoint. A woman cannot appear on TV as an announcer in an Eastern conservative Arab society. She cannot get dressed in certain ways and cannot be on TV from the first place.
The Women's Affairs Center in the Gaza Strip is concerned with media. It has a unit for television production and documentary movies. Many young Palestinian women start their careers from this place. The center organizes media courses regularly to improve the skills of the trainees so that they become able to work in this field.
The Women's Affairs Center has started training since 1995. We started our own activities by a Canadian producer who trained a group of 15 girls. It was a year and a half of training and documentary production. However, we first renovated the center, implemented for the strategic planning. Then we started a 200-hour training course for some young women who wanted to learn production, shooting, and editing. Our first experience included 12 young women. Then the next year, the number increased to be 20. A year after, the applications were about 100. And we started holding entrance exams and other exams for the candidates. We would also select the best trainees and the ones we feel they would carry on in this field.
I chose to join the Women's Affairs Center by a recommendation of a friend. I was recommended to join it to grow the talent I already have, which is production and television. I went there and registered for training courses for a year and a half. Then, at the end of this year, a movie was produced, or it was a documentary that was done as a production experience.
Here is a group of young women who are being trained in many kinds of television skills, like voice, filming, lighting, and production.
We asked the center to hold these courses because we needed a staff for dramas in the movie. We wanted to know how to create drama in the movie, so it was not a regular shooting. It had to be professional.
I'm the camerawoman of drama and documentary films. I was the camerawoman of Notice and The Ways, two drama films. I'm also one of the editors of the film Where Are My Stuff?
From the first places, I grew up in a sports house and was brought up doing sports. My family was and is still supporting me. They are the ones who encouraged me in this field. This has made me more courageous and honest. My father, may Allah grant him health, is the one who advises me and discusses everything with me. My father and I are close friends, and I consult him about everything. He tells me what to do without being persistent.
Actually, my family is very proud of me. I worked on the movie Hope Remains a Title and won first place, and that was the first movie I won first place for in the Cinema and Art Production Festival. Since then, everyone started supporting me and telling me what to do. They gave me the choice to go anywhere.
There's a story for my journey. Leaving home to office means traveling from east the strip to the west. This path was a minefield for me. As soon as I reached my office, I went on air and reported news happening on my way there. There were cars bombed on my way and citizens killed. One time, Israel hit a market on the same road, Omar al-Mukhtar Street. So the way itself was a story for me. Leaving home and reaching office was martyrdom. Reaching office meant I had a new life. During the war, we didn't know the source of the shelling. There was shelling by tanks, planes, and boats. That was a really wild war, as the only people moving in streets were either fighters or journalists. Press men were bombed either by targeting their vehicles or their offices. We were targeted in Al Alam Channel or Media Group Company with a rocket during work. They didn't consider the existence of journalists in the place, though there were press signs like TV press. The targets were journalists who represent media, and they wanted to silence us. Personally speaking, that war was a media war. Massacres and the killing of the innocent was broadcasted live. I think that holding trials for Israeli leaders or issuing arresting warrants for them by some European courts was motivated by media records. There were warrants of arrest or deprivation of entering some countries. These courts depended on the testimony of journalists. Thus, Israel realized how dangerous a Palestinian journalist could be and what are they capable of to highlight the Palestinian cause and suffering. And also to show that war aims at killing the innocent and not ending the resistance, or terrorism as they call it. The main goal was killing Palestinians. The bombing was random and shallow. They executed massacres, used white phosphorus, and burned people. No everyone was targeted in the strip, either directly or indirectly.
The Palestinian media is a part of the national Palestinian resistance. So everyone is engaged in those clashes. In every Palestinian confrontation during the past 50 years, journalists were in the front with people sacrificing their lives. They were a target of Israeli assassinations. Therefore, this is a historical evidence for the Palestinian media. Even during the last Israeli aggression on the Strip, a number of journalists were targeted and murdered.
I would say something my family may not like. I was destined to have a new life twice after the first and second wars on Gaza. If there's a third one, I will be a martyr. I keep wondering why I'm still alive up till now. I was facing death more than one time. It is the first time to come here after the war. Those memories are ugly, but at the same time, make us feel how strong we are. This place was bombed, and seconds later, we came here again. Some of us refused to get down. This makes me proud of the journalists of Gaza and Palestine, proud of the cameramen and work crews. We are really strong that a rocket was shelled here directly. We were standing here in this direction. We were shooting here with our cameras when the rocket fell here directly on this building. Of course, the destruction remains are still here of what happened in the war. Practically speaking, the moment I would leave home those days, leaving meant we were going towards death. However, when this place was hit by a drone rocket, we started waiting for the F-16 to come. Actually, we turned it into a joke between us and a good spirit. Guys, where would the rockets come from? This direction or that one? This plane or that one? After all, we wanted to work and convey our message. We were scared, but we controlled it and got over it. I would feel I'm on duty and asked to go out and tell the world about what happens and shoot everything to transform the suffering of my nation. If I didn't do this, a mother would lose her children and the child would lose her family with no one knowing about them. Another woman would suffer regardless of being a mother or a sister or a daughter. At the end, it's a duty. It's a testimony for every female journalist in Palestine and Gaza in particular. They are strong. We have unbelievable determination that words cannot express, but we lived that a second time during the Second War. I also confirm that we're going to live the same if there happens any aggression on Gaza. None of the female journalists would back away. We became stronger with more experience.
Isdra has worked in this field since she graduated from university. She was always in the thick of the action. She is known for showing humanitarian news features to the world. Isra has won the award for the best TV correspondent in the Islamic world.
It was something great. I didn't know about that contest. Those people were following up with our work and reports and collected works of hundreds of female reporters and journalists all over the world. At the end, they decided that I deserve the title of the best female reporter in war covering in the Muslim world. I felt it was the first reward after the war. Rewards are not necessarily money or tangible. The idea of having such a title meant that people were following up with what I was doing and appreciating that I was going to death itself for the sake of telling the world that there is a nation being killed and cleansed. There's a nation witnessing the melting of its people by white phosphorus in front of them. I succeeded in delivering this message, and this was what made me happy the most after the war until now. I could deliver the message.
Lots of stories in Gaza, lots of telling stories in Gaza, and lots of people, lots of successful, lots of negative and positive. And sadness and happiness and tears and furs and lots of things that are against life and come with life. It's our turn, it's our responsibility as journalists to work on all those and put it in one circle. And then they cannot say that, oh, because you're a woman, you're sexist in this. No, because I am a refugee Palestinian. I know how to speak in my issue and how to present my own issue. This is my issue. This is my homeland.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
Children rummage through Deir al-Balah dump on a constant basis. Among them is an 11-year-old called Fadi. He goes to the dump located in central Gaza after school each day. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Ola Musam, writer. This article is published under the heading danger doesn't stop children from working in Gaza's dumps. Stay tuned for more. Children rummage through Deir al-Balah's dump on a constant basis. Among them is an 11-year-old called Fadi. He goes to the dump located in central Gaza after school each day. "We have no choice," says his father Mustafa, who accompanies Fadi as they research for material they can retrieve and sell to recycling plants, adding, "If we don't do this, we will starve to death." Mustafa, a mechanic, has been unemployed for 7 years now. Both he and Fadi have been injured while working at the dump. The dangers of this work were demonstrated earlier this year. In January, Osama al-Sarsik, 14, died at a dump in Johr al-Lik, south of Gaza City. Osama had gone to work at the dump with his father, Arafat. Together, they would collect any plastic and metal, particularly copper and aluminum, they could sell. "We had to make a living. It was a cold, rainy day," Arafat said, adding, "but the weather didn't stop us. We had to make a living." They had been at the dump for approximately 2 hours when Arafat realized that Osama was missing. Arafat's first thought was that his son had been attacked by dogs. Osama's body was found following a lengthy search, and it was determined that he died from traumatic asphyxia. Arafat relies on his meager earnings from collecting recyclable material to feed his family. For the past 4 years, he has had no other source of income. Osama was the eldest of his 5 children. The child's death prompted the Gaza municipality to ban the public from accessing the dump. The ban was contested by a number of people who depend on collecting reusable or recyclable waste for a living. According to Marwan Al-Ghul, an official with the municipality, most people who collect material from the dump are unaware of how dangerous their work can be. He said, "They are just trying to make ends meet. We're trying to find a solution urgently, especially because child labor is increasing due to the Zionist regime's blockade." Omar, a father of 7, has refused to stop collecting waste from dumps. 2 of his sons, aged 18 and 10, work with him. He said, "Sometimes I am not able to provide enough food for my family." A blacksmith by training, Omar has long been unemployed. By collecting waste, he only makes a small sum, up to $9 per day. "When I started doing this work, I felt ashamed," he said, adding, "but I no longer do. No one can stop me from scavenging. The officials want to stop us, but I and many others will keep doing this work. I don't want to do it, but I also don't want my children to starve." The latest available data from the Palestinian Central Bureau of Statistics suggests that less than 1% of Gaza's children aged between 10 and 17 do either paid or unpaid work. Gaza's Social Development Ministry, nonetheless, believes that child labor is on the rise due to the Zionist regime's blockade. Earlier this year, the ministry undertook a survey of 10,000 families in various parts of Gaza with an income of less than $250. The survey, so far unpublished, found that 60% of parents who responded would be willing to have their children working as a last resort. Child labor in Gaza is the result of poverty, the Israeli regime blockade, and unemployment, said Iman Omar, a social worker with the ministry. Most of the children who work also go to school. They work with their fathers or brothers in dumps or selling things, he said. Sharif 9 collects plastic material, empty cans, and other metals from Gaza's streets every day. As his father is dead, Sharif works to support his family. He said, "And I want to save enough money so that I can buy a smartphone. And all my schoolmates have smartphones and they watch soap operas and cartoons. We don't have a computer or a phone in our home." Another boy doing similar work is 11-year-old Husam. His father has a disability and has long been unemployed. Street cleaners and other people have tried to stop Husam from collecting material, but he has kept doing so. He loads all the plastic and metals that he gathers from dumps and from streets onto a cart, which his older brother then brings to a recycling plant. The only significant precaution he takes is that he avoids dumps near hospitals, out of fear he will be contaminated by discarded syringes. Along with his brother, Husam can make about $6 per day. He goes to a dump early each morning in the hope that he will be the first person there, Husam said. "Some days I cannot collect anything. That's because there are so many other children and even adults doing this kind of work."
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, dini, wal-azam ghayru dini, Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to talk about the rules of Hajj, in fact, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini. The son of Ayatollah Ha'iri, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'iri, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, as always, our guest speaker in the studio. Sheikh Javid, we are talking about the rules of Hajj and in general, of course, but in particular, we were talking about the rules of prohibitions of Ihram, according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. And we've started, in fact, talking about the prohibitions of Ihram from two episodes ago. Let's continue that and let me, ask you this question to the start of this episode with. Because in the last program near the end, you were talking about having no roof, actually, like you're not allowed to walk in the shade, right?
Yes.
So, especially when you are going for a long place to place, like a distance, like for example, from Shajara to Mecca, it's a long distance. So,
sure.
Do you have to, like, again, have nothing over you? Like, for example, if you take a cab or a bus or whatever it is that you see some of the pilgrims, in fact, use some means of transport. So is it allowed for the Shias?
And this is a very important question because many Shia Muslims living in predominantly Sunni populated countries are under the impression of the Sunni, environment and Sunni jurisprudence, and they tend to walk or to move under the under shade. It is not permissible for a Shia Muslim who is wearing ihram to walk under shadow or to be under shade, okay? And of course this rule is applicable to men, according to males, of course. They should not, because as far as women is concerned, they should cover their head, the shade is there.
Yes.
And so when it comes to means of transportation, of course, according to His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, it's not permissible to take a taxi and travel from, let's say, from Masjid Shajara, which is the miqat for the people who move out of Medina and leave for Mecca. It's not permissible for them to travel by taxi or to sit in on a bus and travel to Mecca. Of course, there are special means of transportation. There are roofless cars. There are roofless buses without roof. And of course, pilgrims who do not want to travel under shed or under the shadow must travel by those
special cars.
Cars, yes.
Yeah, buses.
Now, the best solution for such pilgrims who are concerned about not wearing or not taking such means of transportation is to travel at night, you know. When you travel at night, there is no such problem. Whether you are traveling by taxi or by bus, you can travel,
mm-hmm.
and there is no shadow to move.
Right.
Yes, because it's dark everywhere, so it's best to choose to travel at night rather than day.
I see.
This is a problem which many pilgrims encounter while performing Hajj.
So it is possible, in fact, to travel at night rather
yes,
than,
sure.
Walking in the sun. Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program and our questions here in the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Stay with us.
لا إله إلا الله والله أكبر.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the Library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about the rules of prohibitions of ihram. Sheikh Javid, would you continue? If there are any of those prohibitions left, I would like to hear that.
Yes, there are some prohibitions which we also need to learn. Of course, one is covering of the face by females. You know, we know that men cannot cover their head; they cannot cover their faces. But as for females, there are some, you know, females who might want to cover their faces while performing Hajj. And there are some Indians who wear the face mask. Of course, it's not permissible mm-hmm. to wear the mask or to cover the face. As you can go and you will see, men and women should not cover their faces. Mm-hmm. Women should also not cover their faces. Maybe they might be doing it outside Mecca or elsewhere, but as long as they are in Mecca and they are wearing the ihram and they have made niyyah for ihram,
mm-hmm.
they should not cover their faces. Now, there's another condition. We talked about being under the shadow, of course, but there is another condition, taking out blood from the body, you know. It is not permissible to take out blood. And, of course, to do anything which will cause your skin to bleed, okay,
mm-hmm.
it is not permissible. And then we have cutting nails. It's not permissible to cut nails as long as you're wearing the ihram, okay.
As for the bleeding, if some accidents happen, like
yes.
That causes your skin actually to have a rupture and then there would be bleeding. So
yeah,
is there atonement again attached here?
You know, things which are not under your control and things which happen to you without you being in control of it,
mm-hmm.
You're not to blame in these scenarios.
I see.
So bleeding might happen. Accidents do take place while you are ihram. Maybe you might break your legs, you might hurt yourself. No one wants to hurt himself willingly, but mm-hmm. and this is just a matter of accident. Accidents do not make atonement obligatory.
I see. But if you have an accident with a car, for example, yes, while you are traveling, like from Masjid Shajara to Mecca, right?
Yes.
If you happen to have an accident and then you'll end up in a hospital somewhere like that and you need to go under the knife while right, you are unconscious, so they give you anesthesia, right?
Yes.
So does that interruption of your Hajj, ritual render your Hajj tamattu void?
Of course, if you are hospitalized and you will not be able to perform or to complete the Hajj rituals, you will have to do it next year because you will lose the opportunity and the time.
No, if you happen to be in a hospital, for example, one day or two, and
no,
then it will come
not,
back and complete
your
ritual.
Never. It will never make your Hajj void. You will continue and you will go on with performing your Hajj, of course, because the time is not that much limited. You will be able to. For example, if you leave for Mecca on the first day of the Hajj, you will have 9 days, okay?
Exactly.
You will have probably 9 or 8 days at least to perform Hajj. So within this period of time, you will be in hospital for 2 days or 3 days. After that, you will rush to Mecca. To Mecca, and you will perform, let's say, the tawaf, then you will do the...
Even if you can complete your Hajj ritual on a wheelchair.
Yes, you can do it. The Holy Prophet of Islam in the early period of Islam performed the tawaf while riding a camel, and he was on a camel performing Hajj. There were many sick people who were not able to walk on their feet, and they performed Hajj while they were being carried on the shoulders of other pilgrims.
Yes.
And there were many pilgrims who were riding their camels, their quadrupeds.
Yes.
And they were doing it, and there was no objection to people doing it. And this time around, of course, pilgrims who want to perform Hajj using the wheelchairs, of course, they can do so. And then there are two other prohibitions which I would like to touch on. And one is extracting teeth, as stated by scholars, if you want to pull out your tooth or get one of your teeth extracted, it's not permissible. It is forbidden because it will lead to kind of bleeding, and extracting definitely will lead to bleeding, so it's not permissible. And then carrying arms is not permissible. If you have a rifle or a pistol in your luggage, you should not carry it while you are wearing ihram.
What about a knife or a sword that is...
Anything, arm is arm, anything which is called arm. If you have, for example, a kitchen knife, you keep it in your kitchen. You are not supposed to take it out as a weapon and carry it with you for some reasons. Okay,
Okay.
So it's not permissible. And last but not least, because we are running out of time, I would like to touch on one issue which is very important, and that is the tawaf and nisa, okay?
Right.
This is not one of the prohibitions, but since it's important, I would like to conclude this discussion with tawaf and nisa. Of course, tawaf and nisa is a Hajj ritual, part of the Hajj ritual, which is particular to Shia Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
The Shia Muslims must perform tawaf al-nisa in order for them to become halal for their spouse, okay? Mm-hmm. Tawaf al-nisa is done after shaving, okay? One should perform tawaf in its prayer. And it's the last rite, the last practice, the last ritual that one should perform. No one, Shia Muslims should make sure that they do not forget.
I see.
The tawaf al-nisa. And if they happen to forget it, they should choose someone else or a representative to perform this tawaf and its special prayer on their behalf.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. And thank you for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
لا إله إلا هو لَهُ.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.